Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the second weekend of July 2025. It is, well into the summer season here. Days are getting shorter, but still plenty of length into the warmest part of the year here in Southeast Alaska. And hope you're getting a chance to get out and explore. I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com. Or you can check out my website, sitkanature.org, to see what I've been up to and discovering in the natural world. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded this past week with Elizabeth Thomas. She is a paleoclimatologist based out of the University at Buffalo. She's been in Sitka doing field work this summer, part of a larger project looking at the post-glacial history of the area here around Sitka. And she took some time out of her work to visit with me. We'll go ahead and start the conversation off with her explaining what the water cycle is and how it plays into the research that she does, and we'll go on from there.
We mostly think about rain and snowfall and how that changes seasonally, and also like where do those storms come from and how that impacts how wet it is in a region or how much evaporation happens, especially in summertime. The source of all water here in Sitka is the ocean, so that's water that's evaporating off of the ocean into the air and then raining or snowing down on us out of the atmosphere, and then of course flowing across the surface in rivers, seeping into the groundwater. And what my team works on mostly is lakes, and so those lakes are basins that catch that water in that part of the water cycle on the surface.
So the cycle then is just like it comes out of the sky, it evaporates, and comes out of the sky again later.
Yes.
And I mean, that's the, obviously, there's complications, side trips, side quests, as they say, going down into the ground and maybe being there for thousands of years in some cases, or into these basins that are closed, or back into the ocean, or all the different complicating factors, I suppose, that make it more interesting. Yeah, we definitely see the direct, like, it's falling, and maybe not so much evaporation here. I imagine there's some.
Yeah, you can actually see, because it's so wet here and there's so much plant life, there is quite a lot of what we call evapotranspiration, where the plants are actually releasing water out of their leaves. I'm sure folks have experienced this and like watched clouds sort of form off of a hillside. I was watching this just the other day here in Sitka, looking up at the mountains around town. And you can just kind of see clouds forming out of the forest. And that is evapotranspiration happening in real time. That's plants essentially breathing out water and forming clouds right above them because we're so close to the dew point temperature.
I always wondered about that. You know, you see fractured clouds kind of on the hillsides. And it's just like the dynamics of that always made me curious. I guess it's the equivalent of us seeing our breath on a cold winter day sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, the other day I was on a jog. I think it was 4th of July morning, that beautiful sunny morning, and nice and cool out. I was a little bit behind them, and they turned back to see me, and it just looked like I was steaming. I was, in fact, steaming. I was making my own cloud, and that's exactly what's happening with the trees. They're transpiring. So they're an integral part of the water cycle. They're putting water back into the atmosphere and recycling a lot of that moisture that's falling here in Sitka and elsewhere in Southeast. They're a key part of that cycle, making a lot of that evaporation or transpiration happen.
Interesting. And I guess I'd heard about that in like the context of the Amazon rainforest, you know, that so much water vapor, and then that's actually what seeds the clouds for more rain in the first place. And I don't know if the first place is the right way to put that, but as part of that, you know, continuing cycle. And I hadn't really thought about it here because I think about the, you know, rain coming from the ocean so much, which, you know, of course our storm systems do, but the moisture still going in the air. Is that different than, like, does that show up differently somehow than the water that's just evaporating off of surfaces of the ocean or the lakes? Or is it pretty much, you know, that process is the same, having it go through a plant as opposed to directly from water to atmosphere, even, I guess, snow to atmosphere in some cases?
That's a good question. What do you mean by is it different?
Well, so, you know, I heard you talking before we started recording, like one of the things that you're looking at is isotopes in the water, and it matters, like, part of what I'm interested to understand a little better is, mm-hmm. is like you're seeing these signatures of like there's no evaporation happening or there mm-hmm. was tons of evaporation happening. Yeah. And so presumably what's in the evaporated water is differentially selecting these isotopes somehow. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's probably just physics and weight. Mm-hmm. What evaporates is easier is probably lighter, I guess would be my guess. But I'm wondering if like there's a selection mechanism that's happening because of how plants are uptaking. And so then the water that moves through the plants is actually would have a different signature in the isotopes or whatever than the water that's just directly going from the water to atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe we can pick
yes.
that apart a bit.
Please.
We'll start with thinking about isotopes in the water cycle.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you're aware, but we can go back to basics. An isotope is the same element, so an atom of the same element, but with a different mass. So in water, there's hydrogen and oxygen. Hydrogens identify as hydrogens because of the number of protons they have. They have one proton, and every hydrogen has one proton. But some hydrogens, some very few rare hydrogens, have one proton and one neutron. So they actually, in their nucleus, so they actually weigh twice as much as most of the hydrogen in the universe. And we call that deuterium. And so that deuterium, because it weighs more, it forms stronger bonds. And so as you correctly guessed, the heavier isotopes are more difficult to evaporate. And they also form stronger bonds when they're condensing. And so they rain out more easily. And so when water is evaporating off of the ocean, the vapor above that, above the ocean, preferentially has less of that heavy hydrogen. And then when those clouds then come here over southeast, the vapor has less of the heavy hydrogen, the deuterium, than the ocean water. But then when it condenses and forms raindrops or snowflakes, that condensed water has preferentially more deuterium than the vapor that it's coming from. And so we can actually track these signatures of evaporation and condensation through the water cycle. And then, so there's isotopes of hydrogen, and there's also isotopes of oxygen, which is the other element in water. So there's oxygen 16, which has 8 protons and 8 neutrons, and oxygen 18, which has 8 protons and 10 neutrons. And so just like with hydrogen, that heavier oxygen behaves very similarly as the heavy hydrogen. And then, so I've told you that the rain and snow that are falling here in Sitka and anywhere on Earth tend to be lighter. They have less of those heavy isotopes than the water in the ocean. And then when you evaporate that again, so let's say there's rain that falls and then it percolates into the soil and it gets sucked up into a plant, or it percolates into through streams and into a lake, and that evaporates off of the lake surface or out of the leaves of that plant. That evaporation step does exactly the same thing, where it's preferentially evaporating the lighter isotopes compared to what's in that body of water. And so when there's a second step of evaporation, that water, that resulting water vapor becomes even lighter. And you asked if there's a difference between that water evaporating off of a lake or water transpiring out of a leaf. And this is not my area of specialty. We're getting pretty niche. Mm. But my understanding is that it's not any different.
Okay.
So a plant, as far as we know, with some minor exceptions, when plants suck up water through their roots, or non-vascular plants are sort of osmotically pulling up water, they do not fractionate those isotopes. So fractionation is that step that preferentially takes the lighter isotope rather than the heavier isotope. And plants don't fractionate when they're sucking up water into their roots, into their bodies, and then the evaporation process behaves just like evaporation off of a lake. But a leaf is a much small, you can think of a leaf as a lake or a puddle, but it's like a little teeny tiny puddle.
Yeah.
And so the equations that we use actually to define transpiration, the fractionation of isotopes during transpiration, are the same equations that we use when we're describing that off of lakes, but we expect that to be a much smaller pool of water than a lake.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And I guess I don't know whether, I don't quite know how plant water works within the plants, I guess. You know, they're using it for something. They're not just straws, right? So, you know, if it ends up being incorporated into tissues or things like that, then, I mean, I guess that's where I was kind of curious, where I would imagine if there was a difference, it was the difference was in what tends to be incorporated versus not. But it sounds like from the folks that have studied, based on your understanding at least, there doesn't seem to be a preferential sort of incorporation of some isotopes versus others.
Yeah. So by and large, though, there's no difference if you look at like the pool of water in the leaf and evaporate that compared to the pool of water that's a lake and evaporate that. But then definitely all the like biosynthetic reactions that are happening in a plant where a plant takes water and uses it to do photosynthesis. Of course, that's one of the ingredients of photosynthesis to make that the plant uses to make sugars. That water, because anything that's any biological activity, anything that's enzymatically mediated, so there's a protein enzyme that's making that reaction happen, that's making that photosynthesis happen, those enzymes preferentially break the bonds of the light isotopes because that's a bond that's easier to break. And so plants tend to have lighter isotopes in terms of hydrogen and oxygen than the water that they're using, the water pool that they're using.
I see. So, yeah, and I guess just thinking back the steps, so the rain, if the heavier isotopes are preferentially falling out, then further inland you go, then the more depleted, relatively speaking, the rain would be?
Yeah, you got it.
Is that kind of how that works?
Totally. Yeah. Like farther up a mountain
you go? Oh, even just farther up.
Yeah, because if I'm not sure about 3,000 feet here in Sitka, that could make a difference.
Yeah.
If the cloud base that's raining out is at sea level, or maybe let's say it's 1,000 feet, and that's raining out here over town, and then it goes up Harbor Mountain and rains out over Harbor Mountain and rains out all the way in between. If you were to look, catch rain at the base of the mountain and then up at the top of the mountain and in between, it would be lighter and lighter as you go up higher. Because you're totally right. Those heavy isotopes are raining out first, and then you're left with just light isotopes. But certainly, we would expect if we measure rainfall isotope values here in Sitka versus rainfall isotope values where we just were last week in Cake, the Cake rainfall would probably be more isotopically depleted. It would have only the lighter isotopes because that rainfall, assuming it came off of the ocean, which most of it does, would have to go up and over Baranof Island before it ends up a little farther east.
So in a situation where maybe we had weather thunderstorms, say, coming from the east here from the mainland, those would be we would expect those to have much less heavy isotopes because it's probably that's mostly vapor that evaporated from land and is now coming this way as opposed to coming from the ocean. Now, we don't get very much rain like that here, I don't think. But in principle, in a rain event, like if you were measuring and sampling, you could identify, this water isn't from the ocean, it's from the mainland kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, and you're getting at the heart of the matter of how we use isotopes, actually. So my team, we're looking at isotopes back in time, and we can talk about how we reconstruct those back in time. But if we see a change in the isotope values, that's telling us something about what either where those storms came from or what style of rainfall it was. So we actually don't have, there's almost no observations of precipitation isotope values in Southeast Alaska. There's a global network of isotopes in precipitation all over the world, and there's also a network of isotopes in precipitation in the U.S., but there are none of those stations are here in Southeast, and so that's something that we would like to change.
We have enough rain here. It seems like we ought to have a few of those.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, and the gradient also just between thinking about the communities like, you know, moving from south to north, Ketchikan, Sitka, and then inland out, you know, Wrangell, Petersburg, and then getting up into like Haines and Skagway where it's distinctly drier, or Yakutat on the outside where it's distinctly wetter.
Yeah.
You know, that might be interesting. And then you'll have these massive rain events, which especially in the fall cover the entire region. it might be interesting to be like, oh, okay. And
those all look the same.
Yeah. But otherwise, subtle differences of direction of the wind. Like, is it shooting up, you know, Chatham and Lynn Canal, or is it coming across the coast mountains there in the St. Elias Range, you know, in order to get like between Yakutat and Haines or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems like it could be interesting just to see how quickly things are changing over this topography and area.
Yeah. And also, even if we're, I mean, it's a lot to ask it to immediately establish all these like rainfall collection stations all across Southeast. But even one at one site, we don't know if there's like the Pineapple Express atmospheric rivers coming in. Do those have a different signature than other storms coming off of the ocean? Probably. They come from a different part of the ocean and they're sort of coming. It's a lot of moisture coming from the tropics all at once. Versus maybe the Aleutian Low recycling a lot of moisture from the North Pacific and carrying that here, and so we actually just don't even know if those different kinds of storms have different isotope values. We also don't know if the isotopes in winter, which presumably are slightly different, coming from slightly different parts of the Pacific Ocean, if those storms have different isotope values than summer.
Yeah,
and what we can do if we know that is look back in time and say, okay, let's say, for example, we happen to learn that Pineapple Express rainfall events tend to have relatively enriched isotopes, so more positive than other more of those heavy isotopes than other rainstorm events. We can look for that signature back in time and see if there was more or less of this like atmospheric river events back hundreds or thousands of years ago, and learn something about the sort of past water cycle history here in Sitka.
Kind of prevailing weather patterns.
Exactly. But without knowing what those modern day signatures, isotope signatures are of precipitation, it's really hard for us to look at these records that we're generating in the past and know what is that telling us.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's interesting to consider the broader pattern of weather that we have here, where, you know, I guess they call them mid-latitude cyclones or something like that, where my understanding is that like hurricanes and tropical storms are fueled by evaporation in the area. So warm seas is important. Once they transition to, if they transition to this mid-latitude kind of thing, those are fueled, and there tend to be much larger storms spatially, like they take up a lot more area, but they're fueled by temperature difference in the latitudes, which is why they become more strong in the fall and winter when it's colder north and relatively speaking. But you can see, like, sometimes you can follow across the Pacific Ocean these tropical storms that move west and then kind of wrap up around Japan, and then they circle back around and then come across the Gulf of Alaska. So it does, I mean, I don't even know how you could begin to like look at, but it just does make me wonder, like, okay, what's the water signature, you know, the isotope signatures of this water as it's moving across? Presumably it's picking up moisture and depositing moisture, you know, in a fairly continuous fashion, both directions, you know, all the way along. So there's different, I guess, you know, we've been talking about the water coming from the ocean, but is there a difference in, I mean, there's a lot of evaporation happening in the tropics relative to the North Pacific, for example. So I might assume that there's a relative depletion of the, you know, or concentration, as the case may be, in warmer ocean versus colder ocean, where there's more evaporation happening at the surface.
Yeah.
So you can tell based on that even where the rain evaporated from, potentially, or...
Yeah, so we think a lot about moisture source, because you're totally right, the isotopes do change a lot during that transport trajectory. And I have colleagues whose entire careers have been to use weather observation data and model where the moisture is evaporating, where it's condensing along these transport paths. And what they find is that the isotope value is a really wonderful integrator of how far, sort of the median transport time of that air mass. And so if most of the moisture evaporated from the tropics way over in the West Pacific, that, and then that travels all the way around the Pacific Ocean and comes here, and let's say 80% of that moisture is from that tropical evaporation, that will be tend to be more depleted, have less of those heavy isotopes, because it traveled so far and rained out quite a bit along the way, rained out those heavy isotopes. But if there's the vast majority of that moisture evaporated locally, like off of the North Pacific right here off the coast, that would tend to be more isotopically enriched because it hasn't rained out so much. The other key piece of the equation is that if you measure the isotope value of the ocean here versus in the tropics, it's they are going to be a little bit different, but not that much. That different.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Is that because there's just enough mixing to overcome whatever? I mean, I guess we haven't mentioned this. We're talking about isotopes like there, but are we talking parts per million, per billion? Like, what are the...
Yeah, it is parts per thousand.
Parts per thousand. So there's that many that... Okay, so it's not like crazy, crazy rare, but rare enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
So parts per thousand. And then I suppose... I mean, I know that there's tritium, which would have, like, in hydrogen, but that's that's rare enough that it isn't really relevant for what you're doing?
Yeah. That's a very rare isotope. It's also unstable.
Oh, yeah.
And so we don't track it through time.
Yeah.
But that's actually why we have this global network of isotopes in precipitation, is that network was established during the Cold War to monitor atmospheric nuclear weapons testing, because tritium is anthropogenic, and it is made when we blow up nuclear weapons in the atmosphere.
Yeah, I can't remember what the half-life of that is now. I guess
me neither.
It's not that long, though.
No.
Yeah.
No, and so we certainly wouldn't find it in, like, in our lake sediments that are hundreds of years old.
So in the project in particular, so, like, it's helpful to understand what's going on. It seems like that's very much a work in progress. Like, okay, what about the current patterns? Can we start saying? And are you just looking at the carbon and, I mean, sorry, not the carbon, the hydrogen and oxygen? And that's pretty much, I mean, that's water, right? So, but are there other elements that come into the sort of the analysis overall with the work that you're doing? Or is it just primarily focused on those two with water?
Yeah. So, in order to study isotopes in the past, I think this is what you're asking, yes?
Yeah.
We can't just look at... We need fossil water if we want to measure the isotopes of hydrogen and oxygen. And the only place in the world... There's two places I know of that we can... Three places that we can find fossil water. One is ancient groundwater that's been stuck in an aquifer for a long time. The other is ice cores, where it's literally snow that has been turned into ice and preserved there in layers through time. And then the other is ancient pore water in marine sediments. And so, but those are all very sort of niche, and we're not going to find those here in Southeast Alaska. There are a few ice cores in the Cordillera, but that's not my specialty, and they're not here on the coast. And we want to study what's happening here on the coast. How's the water cycle here, where there's communities and ecosystems that we care about? How is that changing? And so we have to look to ways that the water isotope values are recorded for thousands and thousands of years without it being the actual fossil water molecule. And so what my team does, there's several different ways to do this, but my specialty is looking at organic biomarkers. And so these are molecules that are produced by living things made out of hydrogens and carbons. And those are then preserved as the individual molecules in lake sediments. And we look at a couple different kinds of molecules to tell us different things. There are some that we look at to tell us about past temperature, and some that tell us where we can look at the hydrogen isotopes, and that tells us about the past hydrogen isotope value of precipitation. And those molecules that we use to look at the hydrogen isotopes are called leaf waxes, sort of this collective bucket of molecules produced by plants. And just like the oils that we produce on our skin as a protective coating against our skin drying out, all plants in the world, no matter what plant you can think of, they all produce leaf waxes also. And these leaf waxes are simple long chain carbons with hydrogens sticking off of them. And those hydrogens on those leaf waxes come from the water that the plant uses. And the hydrogen isotope value of those leaf waxes, therefore, is linearly related to the hydrogen isotope value of the water that the plant uses. we need to know what that linear relationship is. And so there's a lot of work that my community has been doing and that my group specifically has been trying to understand, like, okay, if a plant uptakes water, how does it isotopically, how does that isotopically change as it goes from H2O into this leaf wax carbon, hydrocarbon compound? But we have that moderately well constrained as far as we know, at least for other parts of the Arctic where I've been working. And so then we can use that hydrogen isotope value of the leaf waxes to see, we can measure that hydrogen isotope value in lake sediments going back 10,000 years or more. And that tells us about the hydrogen isotope value of precipitation through that time.
So I guess there's an assumption that's kind of underlying this, maybe, that the source isotope fraction, you know, how much there is to begin with, is relatively stable over time. Or are there ways of like the amount of deuterium basically in the water to start with, like what's your baseline? If that shifts over time, then you would assume that everything downstream is going to shift as well a little bit.
Yeah.
And I guess I didn't know if there's a way to sort of, is it either an assumption that is pretty stable, and which would make some sense to me, I guess, mm-hmm. not knowing really much about any of the processes that generate or maintain that. But I also could imagine that it varied over time, mm-hmm. and like you would want to like, I think when they're doing the dating, the exposure dating and stuff like that, they have to account for the fact that the sun doesn't send out the same amount of stuff all
yes.
the time. So you have to sort of have these ways of calibrating over time, mm-hmm. you know, for those differences to compensate for that, I guess is the word that I want.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure, like, what sort of situation are you in with these things? Is it is it pretty stable, or is it something that you have to do that kind of compensation for?
That's a great question. The pool of water on Earth is, we can think of it as a closed system. And so the amount, the proportion of deuteriums to hydrogens doesn't change over millions and millions of years.
Hmm.
But that closed system has different pools within it. And the biggest one, of course, is the ocean. And then, so that's the saltwater pool. But we can also think about all the freshwater on the planet is sort of the rest of the water cycle. And that freshwater can be broken into buckets of ice sheets, lakes, groundwater, rivers, and atmosphere. I think that's all of them. Your listeners will probably tell me otherwise. Which is great. But the amount of water in specifically the ice sheet pool changes dramatically as climate changes on these time spans that we're thinking for this project. So if you go back 15 or 20,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago was the global last glacial maximum, and the entirety of North America, or at least the northern part of North America, was covered by ice sheets, continental-sized ice sheets that were 2 miles or more thick. And so the total amount of water in the oceans was less, enough to drop sea level by, I think, like 180 meters, although I might be misremembering that number,
it was
the
a
exact
lot.
Number.
Yeah.
And so that means, because the light isotopes preferentially evaporate off the ocean and become snow that eventually becomes those ice sheets, that means the ocean during the last glacial maximum was isotopically heavier than it is today. And so we do have to account for that. It turns out that we know from fossil seawater, like I was telling you, that the ocean was 1 per mil, so 1 part per thousand heavier in oxygen and 8 parts per thousand heavier in deuterium 20,000 years ago than it is today. And so that's something that we can correct for, number one. And number two, that is a lot smaller than the signals that we're seeing when you look at like changes in season or changes in moisture source, which are on the order of can be tens of per mil in hydrogen space.
Oh, wow. So when you're looking at this sediment, which is going back in this area, potentially upwards of like 15 to 17,000 years, I suppose, mm-hmm. in, you know, and looking at the record from then until the present, I suppose, mm-hmm. in the end, I mean, if it all works well, and then you're looking at these patterns, I imagine that seasonal patterns would be difficult to discern within sediments unless there's like a super strong pattern, just because it just like gets squished in and, yeah. and like how would you even tease that apart within the sediment layer?
Yeah.
And so there's a certain amount of averaging, I imagine, that's just of necessity because you can't slice it thin enough to mm-hmm. to say, oh, this is definitely from, you know, 14,000 and 5 years ago. And so like what's your best case scenario, sort of what kind of resolution are you looking at mm-hmm. in these sorts of patterns? And, you know, I just like, I guess with the context of that, I'm just thinking about now we have like seasonal patterns, but there's also these sort of El Nino-ish patterns that are on the order of years. But then there's mm-hmm. also these decadal patterns mm-hmm. and there's probably, you know, related to the sun and so forth, even century long sorts of patterns, in addition to the really big, you know, patterns of ice agey kind of yeah. things. So all of those are kind of operating in at the same time, essentially, yeah. in this record. And there's, you're getting an average of, you know, everything that's happening over some sort of chunk of time, I guess.
Yeah. Yes. So there's lots of different, as you very nicely just described, there's lots of different time scales that we have to think about. And the way that my team, the way that we think about this is, what are these molecules that we're measuring, or anything that we're measuring in those lake sediments, during what season are those produced? Because that'll tell us, that's the first step. Then we know that by and large, plants are producing new waxes now during this like nice summer, relatively warm growing season compared to winter. And we also know like Swan Lake gets covered by aquatic plants in the summertime, and in winter they die off. And so those aquatic plants are producing waxes during the growing season, during this summer. And so the leaf waxes probably are telling us about summer season only. And so right off the bat, we know, okay, with this proxy, which we call these things that we use to study past climate change proxies, because we're not measuring those directly or observing them directly. With this proxy, we are looking at primarily summer growth, plant growth. And then that pool of water that the plants are growing in, that has a specific seasonality also. And we know, we were just looking this morning at the isotope value of lakes that my team has sampled, and we've measured the isotope value and compared that to the isotope value of rivers in the region. And it seems like rivers tend to be more depleted, so they have those lighter isotopes. So either they're being supplied by snowfall from higher elevations that has had the heavy isotope rain out, and now it's just the lead isotope left, or they're sort of supplied by winter precipitation or some like groundwater mean annual signal, whereas lakes tend to be summer biased. They have more enriched values. And so the plants that are growing around the lake, probably in the, we haven't measured soil water isotopes, but my guess is it would look really similar to the lake water. The plants that are using the soil water, so the terrestrial plants, and then the aquatic plants growing in the lakes, they're growing in the summertime, and they're using rainfall that happened in the summer. So they're telling us about summer season precipitation isotope values. And then, so right away we know, okay, we're not looking at winter unless we do some hard work and try to find a lake that tends to be winter biased. And then, how many summers are the lakes averaging? Are these sediments that we're sampling, how many summers are being averaged together? And the answer to that depends a lot on what lake we're talking about. If the lake is if that sediment is being deposited really rapidly and there isn't a lot of biological activity mixing those sediments together, then you might be able to look at, you know, a 1 centimeter one centimeter thick sediment sample might tell you about 1 to 10 years of summers. In other lakes where the sedimentation is slower, or there's little critters living in the sediment that are mixing that up, it might be 50 or 100 years of summers that are averaged together. And so that really depends on which lake system we're working in. But probably mostly we're looking at this, we're reconstructing summer season variability and not winter.
So what, when you say a summer, like what's the difference between winter and summer in the water isotopes?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to answer without knowing without having any modern observations.
Yeah.
What we know, again, from sort of the data that we've collected from lakes that we've just sampled over the past 5 years or so, and then what we know from rivers that other folks have sampled and measured the isotopes in, is that the rivers are more depleted, and my guess is that those are more winter biased, and so that gives us some...
So why is it more depleted in the winter? Is it just because there's less evaporation happening in the winter, or...
There's a couple of things happening. Yeah. It could be that it's likely that there are different moisture sources. So storms are bringing moisture in from different parts of the world in the winter than in the summer. But then also when it's a little bit colder, the isotope value will tend to be more depleted than when it's warmer. And that's just because of the physics of how rain and snow condense or crystallize in a cold versus a warm atmosphere.
So is that a general temperature signature then that you can look at even apart from the other things?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you look back at some of the very first water isotope value work that was ever done, looking both at precipitation isotopes and then some of the early work in the 1960s looking at ice core data, they measured the isotope values in that fossil ice in the Greenland ice sheet, and they saw that it, by and large, seem to correlate with temperature. And so, but then when you dig deeper, if you have a side-by-side temperature and isotope record, you can actually correct where you've measured temperature independently, whether that's like by a thermometer or by some other method if you're looking back thousands of years. If you then remove the effect of temperature from the isotope values, there's a lot else going on, and that's what's related to these like source signals. And so what my team does is we actually do that. We try to, in the same exact samples, measure a proxy for temperature and these leaf wax hydrogen isotopes so that we can see, okay, what did temperature do through time, and then does that primarily control what's happening with the isotopes, or is it something else that's causing these isotopes to change? And a lot of the work that I've done up to now in my career has been in other parts of the Arctic and the North Atlantic region on Baffin Island, Greenland, and in Fennoscandinavia. And what we see when we do this, where we measure side-by-side temperature and isotopes, is that temperature looks like one thing, where we know over the past 10,000 years, the early Holocene, that's called the Holocene, so like 10 to 8,000 years ago, was warm, and then it cooled towards the last 1,000 years or so, and then, of course, there's been modern warming. But the isotopes, depending on where you are, the isotope values through that same time period can look totally different than temperature. And so we use those two side-by-side records to then, like, remove the effects of temperature from the isotopes and say something about moisture sources.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it's another correction factor, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, that makes sense. Because I imagine there's better ways to get at temperature than the isotopes. I guess it's interesting as I think about, like, just the difference between a river and a lake. Around here, I mean, it depends on the river. Like, some of them are flowing down. Some of them initially... are starting at rock walls where they're flowing, and then they might have a fairly laminar flow, which I imagine is, especially on, well, sunny days when we have them, it is like there's an opportunity for a lot of evaporation to happen there and then to deplete them on the one hand. But on the other hand, there's, you know, lakes, a lot of the rivers have canopy and stuff over, so they don't have as much direct sun. Maybe the surface area is a little different. But lakes, you know, especially a big lake, can have a lot of surface area that's exposed to the sun. So I would imagine that, like, I guess I could construct plausible to me sounding stories about why one might be more prone to evaporation than the other, vice versa. I'm sure it depends on the particular lake, but and the size of the lake and the depth of the lake and all the things that, you know, how warm it gets, essentially. But all of those things are then contributing to the relative depletion of the lake or river of the water body, basically.
Yes, those definitely can contribute, and you're right that evaporation off of a lake would impact the isotope value of the lake water. What we've seen, we haven't made a ton of measurements, but in the, you know, maybe 80 or so lakes that we've sampled and measured the isotope values of, here in Sitka and elsewhere in Southeast, we don't see any really strong signals of evaporation. And but in like other places I've worked, like on Greenland, where we've been able to do coastal to inland transects, we see not much evaporation at the coast and a lot of evaporation farther inland where it's much drier. And we know that it's drier from weather observations. And so what we tend to do, actually, it's kind of cool to see, to have lakes that aren't strongly impacted by evaporation, because then that gives us that, we know then that the lakes are telling us about the sort of original precipitation isotope signature. And then if you remember, think back to when we were talking about transpiration versus evaporation, and I talked about the relative size of leaf water versus lake water pools, it turns out that leaves, because that pool of water is so much smaller, like we can think about it like a tiny little puddle that's evaporating, the water that remains in the leaves after that transpiration happens does have a strong signature of evaporation in it. And so if we can, sometimes this is hard, but if we can effectively separate leaf waxes that are produced by aquatic plants growing in the lake using that unevaporated lake water, and then leaf waxes produced by terrestrial plants, that are, those waxes also get abraded off of the leaves by wind and water and preserved as molecules in the lake sediments, that those waxes from terrestrial plants are produced using that pool of water that has been evaporated, because it's just this little tiny leaf water pool, then we can look at the difference between the lake water isotope value back in time and the leaf water isotope value back in time, and say something about like how evaporative stress impacted these terrestrial plants through time. And so we may be able to say, we may be able to use that pairing of leaf water and lake water through time to say how dry summers were, because if I know anything as a geologist, if thinking back in time, climate is never constant. There's always something changing.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me wonder, it seems like an obvious enough thing that I imagine somebody somewhere must have done it, which is just to sample in a relatively fine time scale, a single lake, you know, and I'm just thinking about here, Swan Lake or someplace where, all right, so we have rain, and then we have sun, and presume, and I don't know how fast, like I guess that's the, like, how fast is this shift happening? If we have a period of 5 sunny days where it's in the 60s and 70s here, like, there's presumably some evaporation happening off of Swan Lake. Is it enough to detect? I don't know. But relative to, like, oh, it just rained a bunch, you know, the days after that, like, is that enough signal that you would be able to detect it in, you know, with the methods that you use? Yeah, I'm just kind of curious about that.
Yeah.
It all averages out, right, when you're looking at this deeper time things. But
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that folks have done, not here in Southeast, but elsewhere. And you can detect that. I think one of the reasons that when we're just walking up to a lake and taking samples, the reason that we're not detecting that evaporation signal is because there is so much rainfall here on sunny days, and even non-sunny days, there is evaporation off of that lake surface. But that rainfall, there's so much rainfall replacing and mixing in with the water in Swan Lake and other lakes in this region that it essentially is like the, you know, it's diluted away. That evaporation signal is completely diluted away and not detectable using these stable isotope values.
So would you maybe be able to detect it if you had a, like, all right, I at the end of 5 days of sun, and then compared that to the beginning of 5 days of sun? Like where you had a baseline of that lake, as opposed to generally speaking, this is what depleted water looks like. But no, actually, specifically, this lake looks, you know, the same or different.
Yeah.
Or is it just not even that much relative even then?
It may not be enough, because if you think about it, it's the very surface skin of the lake that's evaporating, and but the total volume of the lake, and that lake water is constantly mixing as it's getting heated by the sun. The total volume of the lake is much larger than just the surface that's feeling that evaporation. And so it's I think it would require a lot of evaporation and many days of sun in order to see that signal. But that's something we could try.
Yeah. Well, you know, just like, yeah, because I think partly it's just my mind is trying to understand the sort of the limits of like what you can detect versus not. And, mm-hmm. and like, what are the patterns that are, what are the patterns that are happening along the way? But so, yeah, I mean, in the deeper time, obviously, you're somewhat limited by, you know, the waxes that you have and checking that. So then the summer, so yeah, I guess I'm trying to, as I think about like, okay, well, like this summer it's been relatively cool. We didn't have a ton of snow in the mountains over the winter because we had a relatively warm December and January. Mm-hmm. And the snow, it was wet, but it was warm enough that it was, you know, if there was snow, it often would warm up and enough that it would rain and melt off. And so we didn't get a ton of accumulation in the mountains this year. And then February and March ended up being dry. So also no accumulation. So we didn't actually have that much snow in the mountains this year. But then April and May were very dim and cool, relatively speaking. And so the snow hasn't melted off that fast, especially like where it was low enough and there was really not much snow. It melted off pretty quick, but then a little higher, there's still snow remaining. And I remember 2012 was another year where we had a really cool summer, relatively speaking. The snow didn't melt off the mountains very fast. I think we'd had more snow in the winter that year. And so that was, and part of my mind is just like, okay, what is my recent, what's my experience, which is all recent because I'm, you know, geologically speaking, pretty young. Mm-hmm. Yeah, human standards getting less so, but geologically yeah. speaking, very much a youth on this planet. Just like, okay, what was the difference in an average year as we're going into the little ice age or into the big ice ages, right?
Yeah.
Versus now. And if it's, you know, maybe qualitatively it's not that much, but, you know, you kind of get these thresholds where, oh, actually that snow didn't melt in the mountains and now it's accumulating instead mm-hmm. of, you know, melting off each year. Mm-hmm. And maybe at sea level it doesn't feel that different in a given year. And so I guess those are some of the questions that are running around in my mind as I'm thinking about your work here in this project. And you know, you can see you get signal about what's happening in the summer, and I honestly don't know whether it's summer or winter is more important in these kind of climatey things where ice is concerned.
Right.
Maybe they're both important in their own ways, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But like, does one drive, you know, more than the other? And I don't know how, you know, maybe there's other ways of getting at what might have been going on in winter. But I think mm-hmm. about just the very, in the modern time, you know, these Pineapple Expresses and that tend to be in the fall and mm-hmm. winter, you mm-hmm. know, where you can look at the satellite imagery and just see this river of moisture coming mm-hmm. up this way. And I don't know how long, like you were saying, that the isotope gives you an indication of how long that water's been in the air, essentially. Mm-hmm. I don't know how fast that, you know, on the, like you see the river, but I don't really know how fast that water is moving. So I don't know how much it's depleting essentially by the time it gets here. But those are fall, winter phenomena, right? So they wouldn't show up in your, mm-hmm. in your signal.
They may not. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if there's other ways to, you know, to figure that out. But mm-hmm. yeah, those mm-hmm. are the, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously there's no end of complications and you have to
work
with what you can do. But yeah, it does make me curious.
Yeah. For better or worse, most of the proxies that we have for past climate are biological.
Mm-hmm.
And so those that are terrestrial, at least like the in lakes, like in the realm that I work in, tend to be summer biased and be produced sometime during the growing season. There are some algae that bloom very early in the spring, and they can tell us about the lake. We could look at the isotopes of those molecules that those algae make. We know those have a very specific molecule that they produce, and those isotopes of that molecule would tell us about lake water like very early in the spring. So that might be a closer to sort of like snow melt signature. So there are some ways that maybe we can tease apart fall and winter signals if they get preserved through winter and into that spring snow melt season. But yeah, there's definitely aspects that we're missing just by the nature of our work.
Is there a difference between snow and rain? Like, can you tell once it's melted?
Or
not?
No.
Because I guess a lot of it starts at snow and then in the winter,
and then becomes,
you know,
rain,
becomes
down
rain anyway.
At this elevation. Yeah. Yes. There are subtle differences, but on the certainly on the time scales we're working on, no.
Because I was just thinking, like, if you could tell if it was something that was melted snow or, you know, more recent rain, like if there was, if it was taking longer for the snow to melt, and so that was a more later into the growing season source of the water, essentially, which would presumably be then be winter water as opposed to summer water. But you wouldn't, I guess, I'm not sure how you would even know that in the end, unless it showed up in some sort of distinctive way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's kind of amazing to me, like this whole project overall, which this is a part of, you know, and it's a facet in a, you know, I know that the DNA work that they're looking to sort of reconstruct what plants might have been around at the time also gives some indication of climate. I mean, there's, you know, or things just moving in, you know, that had been extirpated during the Ice Age sorts of things. So kind of a couple of different things happening there. And then the more, I guess, purely sort of the, in the lakes where are there's some glacial sort of feeding, like the sediments, and then being able to understand a little bit about the comings and goings of glaciers and that and all of these, and then the volcanic ash, especially around here where we have Mount Edgecumbe and the timing of that and where that shows up in the layers, and all of these things kind of working together to kind of reconstruct this post-glacial climate or ecological climate kind of history of this area. To me, it's really fascinating. Like, I like to try and imagine, okay, what was it like here, you know, and then sea level changing and all of those things. So much of what was exposed at the time is now underwater, but you know, finding these places that are, you know, have a relatively old record. And it seems like, so this particular project that you're here for now, if I'm remembering correctly, this is the second year of it. But you had a prior project, which you got some data from, is it Prince of Wales Island or Doll Island?
Doll Island. Yeah.
And so it's a similar, but you're similar methods. Mm-hmm. And so presumably you're further along in the data analysis.
A little bit, yes.
Yeah, these things. Yeah, it's the, oh yeah, we're out for 2 days in the summer, and that's going to give us 18 months worth of work to do
exactly,
in the lab.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can share a little bit of those results if you're interested. So we have a sediment core, a couple sediment cores from a lake called Parrot Lake on Doll Island. And my postdoc, Sam, has been working on that along with the rest of the team looking at DNA. And we actually have just started in our lab this summer to really dive into processing the biomarker samples. But there are other things that we measure on the sediments as well. Before that, we can look at just like the periodic table of the elements, like what metals and other elements are in the sediments, and those that can tell us something about how the lake is behaving, or like whether there's a lot of material eroding off of the landscape and washing into the lake, or if there's biological productivity in the lake and how those various things change through time. And we can actually look at that, you know, every millimeter or half centimeter through the entire core. So that's at higher resolution than we can do our biomarker and DNA analyses. And so we get this sort of continuous high resolution picture of what the lake and its catchment looked like through time. And because we're using essentially cameras or these like crazy sci-fi x-ray techniques to look at these elemental ratios.
It's giving you a kind of a more picture based on the physical environment.
Yeah, exactly. And what we're seeing is, so there's a couple major climate changes that happened immediately after the Ice Age. We know about 15,000 years ago, all of Earth popped out of the Ice Age, and the Great Northern Hemisphere ice sheet started retreating. That was 15,000 years ago. But then at 13,000 years ago, we were plunged back into the Ice Age. And that's called a time period about 1,500 years long called the Younger Dryas. And then it warmed again at 11,500 years ago. And that's called the Holocene. And that's sort of this warm period that we're living in today. And we can see that in these Parrot Lake sediments. We see the warm period that was the end of the Ice Age. And then you can actually, even just without, with just your eye, you can see that there's, so lake sediments that are that are deposited during warm times are kind of dark brown. And then those that are deposited during colder times, at least in Parrot Lake, are more gray. There's much less of that like dark organic matter in them. And indeed, the elemental ratios, we see more titanium and less silicon. And that tells us that titanium can only be eroded off of the landscape, and silicon can be eroded off of the landscape from minerals, but it could also be produced biologically in the lake. And so sort of the ratio of those two tells us that there was, during the Younger Dryas, during that cold period, a lot more hill slope activity and less biological productivity in the catchment. And then we go back into this warm period in the Holocene, and then it's fairly stable with a couple of interesting oddities that we're still investigating through the rest of the next 11,500 years, with the exception of one element called manganese. And from about 8,000 to 4,000 years ago, before and after that, the manganese is like pretty quiet and boring and just low values. And then between 8 and 4,000 years ago, we see these like really big and rapid and semi-periodic spikes of manganese through time. And manganese, so Parrot Lake is a pretty deep lake, and manganese, if it's in really high abundance in lake sediments, that tells us that the bottom water of the lake had no oxygen. And so we know for most of the Holocene it had oxygen, but then there were these periods, these like between 8 and 4,000 years ago, there was this semi-periodic, like low or no oxygen in the lake bottom water. And what Sam has been hypothesizing is that that means there's been less wind to mix the lake. And it turns out, you mentioned these sort of like El Nino, the ENSO oscillations in climate in the Pacific. And then here in the North Pacific region, that's related, that's controlled a lot by ENSO. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation is related to these ENSO changes. And what Sam knows from previous research that he's done in South America, there's this period in the Middle Holocene, 8 to 4,000 years ago, when ENSO was, there was a lot less ENSO activity. It was a lot quieter, I believe. I hope I'm not misrepresenting that research. And then also it was like tended to be biased. I forget if it was towards La Nina or El Nino conditions. And that in the, at that time in the Middle Holocene, when ENSO was behaving that one way, that would have caused the Aleutian Low to, I think, be relatively weak, which would have resulted in less winds in Southeast Alaska and would have mixed Parrot Lake less. Hmm. And so we can start to learn something about, like, okay, what is atmospheric circulation doing across the Pacific Ocean, this whole Pacific, this large region, by looking at these weird elemental ratios in these lakes here in Southeast.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see as you get some of these other lakes, you know, what parallel and differences there, because mm-hmm. there's such the topography in the region can affect things greatly in terms of weather in a specific area, you know, and so which signals come through where. Mm-hmm. It just is kind of fascinating. It's like this big tracking project, I guess. Oh, we're seeing this. What are plausible stories that lead to this? And then trying to figure out ways to test between them and see which ones, hold up.
Yeah, that's like very true.
Without a time travel machine, you know, that makes it a little more difficult, I suppose, to find modern analogs or, you know, all of those sorts of things. But it seems like an interesting set of projects, I suppose, wrapping together things from, you know, across the ocean basin, really, from the sounds of it, you know, the way that the water moves and transports and the weather systems and patterns. But we're getting to the end of our time here.
Okay.
I've appreciated learning a little bit more about the facet of the work that you're doing here. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we wrap up? Nope.
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. Thanks,
yes.
Matt.
Well, yeah, thank you. And I look forward, hopefully we get a chance to talk again when you get some, you know, get through the 18 months or however long it takes to analyze the data from our Sitka area lakes. And
can't wait to share.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded this past week with Elizabeth Thomas. She is an associate professor at the University at Buffalo. She studies paleoclimate and has been in Sitka doing fieldwork this summer. I want to thank her for taking some time to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show. I'll look forward to being back in a couple of weeks. Until then, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.